Mayo, this is episode 499 of the Happy Hour podcast, which is crazy. Even though I've only been a part of it for the past year, it's crazy that it's been around for so long. Because I remember the very first episodes, which were right around when I joined 9 to 5 Mackin. What, 2013 maybe?
And they were right around when I joined, because I wasn't on it at the very beginning.
It was on Google Hangouts, and they would be posted to YouTube, and it was like, who was it? It would be Seth and Mark Gurman and Zach. And it's come a long way since those Google Hangout conversations, I would say.
Yeah, me and Zach like properly took it over like 2014, like 2014, I think, something like that. And we did it with Dom Esposito for a while, and then it was me and Zach for the longer bit. And then you obviously came in about a little over a year ago now, right? And I think it's been going great, but we got the big milestone, number 500 next week.
And for number 500, we wanted to answer some Ask 9 to 5 Mac questions about anything you want to know, and you should send those to us. You can find me and Mayo on Twitter, Threads, etc. You can email them to us, happyhour@9to5mac.com. And yeah, next week we'll collect some of those and answer them on the episode, which will be very fun. We don't do Ask 9 to 5 Mac as much as we should, because we like hearing from you all, so send us your questions. macOS Sequoia Beta 6 came out this week. And we talked last week about the new permission prompt in macOS Sequoia asking for screen recording permissions from every app you use on a weekly basis or every time you reboot your Mac. And Apple apparently heard all of that feedback from us and from other people. And in Beta 6, it now prompts you for every month. So the first time you update to Beta 6 and launch an app that needs screen recording permissions, you'll see a new pop-up where the two options are allow for 1 month or open system settings, and then you can manage your screen recording permissions there. They've also removed the requirement after every reboot. So once you hit that allow for 1 month button, theoretically, you'll never be prompted by that app again, even if you reboot your Mac.
Within a month.
Yes, for a month. And the one month requirement is certainly better than 1 week, but it still doesn't seem to fit what power users want, and it still seems like there are better ways they could implement this. Like we talked about last week with the staggered prompting, you know, you prompt after a month, then maybe you prompt a few months later, and then you give somebody an option to allow permanently, or even right from the start, add something to system settings where a power user can go in and say, yes, 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 I'm aware of the risks. Never ask me about this again. And none of that's there right now.
Yeah. A month is better than a week, but it's still not quite as, there needs to be more options for reminding. And I still compare it to the location permissions where on an irregular basis, it will remind you about on iOS about location services for apps that have got the permission for always using location, not just while the app's open. And I'm pretty sure that's less frequent than once a month. Could be wrong, definitely. But it doesn't feel like I see that pop up that often. Like you see it a couple of times a year, I'd say, for a particular app, and not that frequently. And that feels about right. And that's for me what I would consider the most sensitive privacy thing, which is location services for screen recording. And like for screen recording specifically, if there's an indicator the screen recording is going on, I almost feel like you don't need a permission. So that would be another route for them to go down. Like how they have a yellow indicator for when the microphone's active, or a red indicator for, you know, or a green indicator for when the camera's active. If they always had a purple indicator when there's screen recording going on, not sure an upfront permission or repeating upfront permission is necessary at all, right? So there's more directions and stuff that they can experiment with, and I hope they explore further down the road. Because in general, screen recording permission for an app is very obvious, because a legitimate app, you know when you're getting screen recorded, right? Like you're doing Zoom or whatever, and you're sharing your desktop. Like it's not like they're hiding it away. You only really need the privacy permissions and the flags and the pop-ups and the indicators to weed out the unscrupulous bad actors, which don't come around very often, right? Like that's a pretty small case, but you have to defend against it. But it's not the day-to-day experience of using your Mac. You're going to be seeing those permissions for perfectly legitimate apps, not for the bad ones. So you want to try and make the experience as good as possible.
And I think part of the problem with this, and I said it last week and I'll say it again, is that Apple hasn't communicated this change to anybody, not to the press. I've asked them multiple times to get more details, not to developers. There's no documentation on this change. There is that one page on the developer website about a persistent content capture entitlement that some developers think maybe would let your app circumvent this pop-up, or at least reduce the frequency of the pop-up. But if you look at that entitlement page on Apple's website, it's literally like three lines with no details on how to get the entitlement. And it's just like, it's clear Apple knew and realized that people were unhappy with this change because they updated it, but they still haven't communicated anything further, which I think would go a long way towards addressing some of the concerns, because there is a lot of questioning and misinformation out there about what this means and how this works and which apps are affected.
Yeah, and entitlement-based solutions are never ideal, because then you're basically like letting Apple pick the winners, right? Like Apple will hand bless a dozen popular screen recording apps
that exactly.
So they don't have to prompt, but then any upstart or newcomer is going to be having an uphill battle to compete. So I don't love entitlement-based solutions. There are occasions when it makes sense, but this thing doesn't feel like something where you need entitlements to work around it. They just need a better base policy, and at least going from a week to a month is going down the right path. Like, it's progress. Yeah. But yeah, communication, documentation would be welcomed.
Last week in Happy Hour Plus, we talked about a tease from Mark Gurman about an M4 Mac that would be getting a bigger overhaul, a bigger redesign, a bigger refresh than just adding the M4 chip inside. And as I was editing the episode, Mark Gurman published his full report detailing that that machine getting a big redesign will be the Mac Mini. So he says the M4 Mac Mini will be far smaller than its predecessor, and it's coming later this year. The new design will be similar to the Apple TV. And even though the overall footprint will be smaller, Gurman does say it could be taller than the current Mac Mini. And I did some rough estimation of just how much bigger the current Mac Mini is than the Apple TV 4K. Mm-hmm. And it's basically twice as big in every dimension except height, where the current Mac Mini is a little taller than the Apple TV 4K. So that's a pretty big reduction in size for the Mac Mini. It almost makes it actually mini, because it hasn't felt very mini in the past, for the past like 5 years at least, kind of in the era of a lot of smaller, more box-sized Windows PCs coming out.
And they have a load of, like, even Intel has the Intel Nooks, I think they're called, like NUCs. They're just like really, really small little computers, kind of competing with the likes of like the Raspberry Pi, which are just like a motherboard standalone. This would obviously be a packaged machine. It wouldn't just be a bare motherboard, but it's bringing the smaller package down to an actual mini size, because the Mac Mini, as it stands today, is a relic of, well, it dates to Intel, but it also dates to the optical drive, right?
Like, yes.
The Mac Mini was defined by the fact that it used to have a slot-loading CD drive in the front of it, and obviously that's long gone. But the actual physical size of it has never really shrunk since. When it was an Intel machine, it had reason to be that big, because they needed the fan, they needed the cooling, they needed the airflow. Ever since it's been an Apple Silicon, it never needed to be that large. They just never changed the industrial design of it until now. So it's very, very great to see. And Mark basically describes it as, you know, an iPad Pro in a small box.
Yeah.
And that makes perfect sense to me, because the iPad Pro is a 5.5mm thin tablet, which also has to pack in battery, display components, speakers, like all this extra stuff. The actual amount of space you need and thermal headroom you need just for the M4 chip is very, 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 very small to get a very, very performant machine. So the fact that they can do that and actually exploit the benefits of Apple Silicon in this product is really nice to see. And what was more of a surprise, he also says that in that smaller form factor, they're also going to be able to deliver the M4 Pro chip, which is what you normally see in the MacBook Pro, right? So not the base model 14-inch, the higher-end 14-inch has the M3 Pro chip in it, and so we expect that to get the M4 Pro chip, which has slightly more GPU cores, slightly more CPU cores, and a slightly higher headroom. But again, if it can fit in a laptop, it can fit in a small box like the Apple TV size.
And he says Apple has tested a version with at least three USB-C ports on the back alongside the power cable and an HDMI port. The current Mac Mini, I think, has two USB-A ports, so it sounds like you'll be losing out on those USB-A ports, which I don't think is a big deal in the year of 2024. I think most people have just moved on to USB-C, and if you haven't, it's easy enough to make that switch.
So to be clear, the current Mac Mini comes in two versions, right?
Yes.
You have the M2 version, the M2 Pro version. So the M2 base model has two Thunderbolt ports, i.e. USB-C, one USB-A and HDMI. So this would be an upgrade or that. If it's got three USB-C with HDMI and power, you're basically swapping one of the USB-A for a USB-C instead. But it also comes in the M2 Pro variant, which has four USB-C ports, Thunderbolt ports, and two USB-A. So you would have a slight I/O downgrade if the M4 Pro Mac Mini doesn't have space for extra I/O on the back. But six ports directly on the machine was pretty insane number. I think most people would take the trade-off of as a smaller and compact design than requiring two USB-A ports, which are very outdated, and then an extra Thunderbolt port that probably was never really filled.
Do you think there's a chance that in order to achieve this smaller design, they might have to move the power supply like to be external, so you'd have a bigger power brick that kind of, and that would kind of negate the purpose of the smaller box, I think. Not entirely, but a little bit.
So it's always, I would always take an external power supply over and make the actual machine smaller, because I feel like, you know, the power supply, like what they do with the iMac, right? Where like the iMac's nice, thin and small, the power supply is a bit chunkier, but the power supply plugged into the wall, what you see on your desk is the nice, thin and small computer. Yeah. So with a Mac Mini, that thing would still apply. But I don't necessarily see, I'm not an expert on power supplies, but I think if you made it a quarter size, you could still fit the power supply internal. It would be my hunch. Just like they do for the Apple TV, right? So I don't think they would have to, but if it turns out that the power plug's a bit thicker to accommodate for it, then I still think it's a worthy trade-off. Mac Minis are used in some weird circumstances, like server racks, kind of environments where they have specially designed bays that they fit in. So I'm sure this will cause some headaches for people that are using it in those kind of contexts. You can make adapters for the bays that can fit the small design, and eventually you make new bays that only fit the smaller design. So there's a migration path there. The current Mac Mini design has been around for a long, long, long time, and it was aging, and it was definitely a candidate for an upgrade. I mean, you just do a teardown of the thing. There's so much empty space in that box. It's like the Mac Pro situation, just on a smaller scale, right? And so this was a great target. The only reason I didn't, in that Happy Hour Plus episode last week, I didn't choose the Mac Mini, just because this design's been lasting for so long. I thought they were just never going to do anything but upgrade the internals, but I'm really glad that they're actually giving it the attention. So it will have a thin, small, you know, puck design for the next 15 years on M4 baseline. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. I don't know if I necessarily need one, but it's an option. Like, I use the MacBook Pro right now, so that has the Max chip in it, but you know, someone slightly less requirements than me, they could use the M4 Pro, MacBook Pro, and then if they got an external display instead, they could slap it with a Mac Mini and use keyboard and mouse. Like, it helps distinguish it more from the Mac Studio as well, I think, because when you're looking at them in the shop, like, the Studio and the Mac Mini kind of overlapped quite heavily. Now they're much more distinct, or they will be when it looks more like an Apple TV. So I think it's a good progress to the lineup, but it doesn't necessarily make it straight paying for me. The other question is, are they going to put the price up or not to accommodate the redesign? But we don't know yet.
The current Mac Mini is what, $599 and $499 for education, which is an insane deal when you think about what you're getting for it. So hopefully they won't raise the price too much. The other thing Bloomberg doesn't address is Ethernet, because the current Mac Mini does have an Ethernet port. So if they did have to use a bigger power supply externally, you could do what they do on the iMac, where they have the Ethernet port built into the power supply, which would be a decent solution if they still want to offer Ethernet as an option, but not compromise making the actual physical Mac Mini itself as small as possible, basically.
Yeah. Or worst comes to worst, use an adapter, right, on one of the USB-C ports. Like, when you Mac Minis stay in the same place, you're not unplugging and replugging anything constantly. So if you have to use adapters and extenders, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world. Like, I personally value it being small. I think that's really cool. And people can put it on the desk, they can hide it away. What people do with Apple TV sometimes is they like stick them, you know, they like tape them to the back of their television, so it like integrates that and hides behind it. You could do that with a Mac Mini. Some people do it already, but it's even better if the Mac Mini is physically smaller. And you just kind of have a little, you put the display on, and then OWC or someone will sell you a little stand that you can just hide behind. Like, that's kind of slick.
When I used the Mac Studio, I had a mount underneath my desk, just like a 3D printed one that I bought on Etsy. And the Mac Studio just lived in there under my desk, and I never saw it. I had a OWC dock on my desk itself that I could easily access ports if I needed to, but it was out of sight and out of mind, basically giving that iMac experience just with more modularity than the iMac offers.
And we're expecting to see this before the end of the year, right? That's what you said.
Yes, that's what he said. This year, he says M4 MacBook Pro, M4 Mac Mini, and M4 iMac.
Okay.
The next year will be the rest of the lineup. So the Mac Pro, the Mac Studio, and the MacBook Air.
Yeah, very looking forward to it. It's nice that there's a big change on the horizon. Happy Hour This Week is brought to you by HelloFresh. HelloFresh delivers fresh, high-quality, pre-portioned ingredients direct to your door with easy-to-follow recipe instructions so you can make delicious meals easily. And for a limited time, kids eat free. Go to HelloFresh.com/happyhourkids to unlock this exclusive offer. One free kids meal per box for 2 months while your subscription is active. Planning, shopping, prepping, and cooking family dinners can be a right ordeal. HelloFresh makes it easy by delivering fresh ingredients to make recipes for everyone to enjoy, including any picky eaters you might have in your family. It's such a hassle to find meals that everyone likes, especially when you have kids to account for, but HelloFresh has a new set of builder plate meals where every member of your household create their perfect plate. No more making dinners to satisfy everyone, just one meal with so many different ways to enjoy it. Meals arrive on the date that you specify with all the ingredients you need and easy to follow recipe cards. They have a changing menu of 50 recipes to choose from each week, so HelloFresh makes it easy to find something the whole family will love to eat, with a lot of variety in there too. With HelloFresh, you can get nutritious and delicious meals on the table easier and faster than ever. Now, Chance, I know HelloFresh sent you some meals to try out, right?
Yeah, the last batch that I got included one of my favorites from all of the HelloFresh boxes I've ever had, and that was a loaded stir fry. And I think, kind of like you said, Maya, one of my favorite things about HelloFresh is you get everything you need in the box, because we've all kind of been in that situation where we're cooking something, then we realize we forgot or ran out of a crucial ingredient, and then you're just left standing there questioning whether you just scrap the recipe altogether, whether you go to the store, and you just don't have to worry about that with HelloFresh. You open the box and it's all there, including everything you need to make sauces and seasonings. And of course, it just tastes better than if you're using a pre-made sauce or something from a can. So for me and my wife, HelloFresh is one of our favorite things to have for dinner, with the versatility and the ease of making it. Gets a big A+ from me and my wife.
And for a limited time, kids eat free. Go to HelloFresh.com/happyhourkids to unlock this exclusive offer. One free kids meal per box for 2 months while subscription is active. That's free kids meals just by going to HelloFresh.com/happyhourkids. HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. Thanks to HelloFresh for sponsoring the show.
We got a bit of a surprise this week because Apple announced that it's opening up the iPhone's NFC chip to third-party apps with iOS 18.1. So you may remember that this previously happened with the NFC chip in the iPhone in the European Union in response to the DMA and Apple's work to comply with the DMA. And now they're saying they're bringing it to a bunch of other countries, including Australia, Brazil, Canada, Japan, New Zealand, the UK, and the United States. So developers will be able to use the NFC chip for things like payments, car keys, student IDs, event tickets, home keys, hotel keys, and a whole bunch of stuff. The question is, there's a line in Apple's announcement saying that to incorporate the new solution for their iPhone apps, developers will need to enter into a commercial agreement with Apple, request the NFC and secure element entitlement, and pay the associated fees. They haven't published any details about that fee structure, how much developers will have to pay. Apple obviously gets a cut of all Apple Pay transactions, so probably they're going to look to make up for that income somehow. But I think the most interesting and most surprising part about this, and it's also what they did in the EU, is that you'll also be able to set a third-party app as your default contactless payment method. So in the Settings app, you can choose to replace Apple Wallet with a third-party app that appears every time you double-click the side button on your iPhone. This caught me off guard when Apple announced it yesterday, just because it seemed like the only reason they did it in the EU is because of the DMA, and they never hinted at having plans to bring it elsewhere. But they were also facing regulatory pushback in other places because of the limitations of the NFC chip. So maybe they just decided to go ahead with it in a rare case of Apple getting ahead of some legislation in certain countries.
Yeah, because it was part of the DOJ US complaint, for instance.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And so clearly it's a target. And I think of, compared to the App Store, it's something where they're much more willing to just cede and be like, okay, Apple Pay will remain the default. If you want to, you can go to the App Store and download a third-party wallet app, and then you have to go into settings and set it as your default, and then it becomes default in functionality. On a functional basis, this seems identical to what they shipped in the EU with 17.4. Mm-hmm. It's purely about the business terms. In the EU, Apple doesn't have any... There's no interception there. It's not like they have a core technology for the NFC apps, for instance. They just let them get on with it. So it's open season, essentially. You have to apply and get approved, and there's some requirements in terms of meeting, you know, like if you're doing a payment app, you have to be registered with a bank and have, you know, accreditation and stuff. But once you get through the approval process, there's no... Apple's not involved in the business side of it at all. It just works. Whereas with this, their press release had that very knowing indication. Developers can apply and agree, as long as they agree to our business terms and pay the associated fees, they can jump on board. Very plainly, not publicly saying what the associated fees were. Now, Apple Pay is different to the in-app purchase system, right? So
right.
Apple Pay does not get 30% of everything you buy with Apple Pay. It's not how it works. The Apple Pay takes 0.15% fee from the card issuers when you use Apple Pay contactless. So it's a much smaller number that they go for. And it's basically like part of just the general interchange fees of a credit card transaction. It just gets lumped in with that. But obviously, if you're getting 0.15% of every transaction that's on done, you know, via contactless on the iPhone, it adds up, right? So they make money off it, don't get me wrong. But it's not like they're going to come in here storming for 30%. It's just a different ball game. For whatever reason, when it comes to non-digital goods, Apple's a bit more reasonable. When you go into the digital side, they want 30% from everybody, including the Patreon nonsense that's come up in the last few days as well. One quick sidebar on the Patreon thing, by the way. Obviously, I think everybody thinks that Apple isn't entitled to 30% of every money that ever exists in the world just because you have an iPhone app. But I am not surprised in the slightest that they're putting pressure on Patreon to change it, because it's exactly the same as a load of other apps that are on the App Store already that were that way. Like Twitch. You know, Twitch, what is Twitch? Twitch is just a platform where a load of creators stream all day long. You can pay for the subscriptions to the creators through Twitch. You can buy bits and currency through the Twitch app. If you buy through the app on the iPhone, everything's 30% more expensive, because they take the cut and Apple gets the cut. So Patreon's kind of done well to avoid having to fall under the purview of the rules. Not saying the rules are right or fair, but it's more like Patreon, through a quirk of history, avoided paying the commission, never having to force it in there. It's caused a lot of blowback and backlash because nobody likes paying more fees, but it's not really out of line with any of Apple's policy. Like, there were a couple of comments I saw that's like, well, now Apple's gonna at risk of losing the Google money, then they're just jumping at everybody for money. I'm like, it doesn't work like that. This is completely in line with App Store policy. If anything, they should have just enforced it five years ago. Not saying that the policy is correct and they shouldn't take that much money and blah, 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 but that is the state of play. The Google search deal has nothing to do with it. With NFC, I have to assume they're probably going to somehow want to inveigle a 0.15% fee, which is the same as what they get from Apple Pay for payment cards, but we won't know. We can only speculate unless it leaks out somewhere. I think this is perfectly good for them to offer, though. Like, from a moral standpoint, it is pretty unfair that the access to, like, the fact that you can hold your iPhone near a contactless terminal and the only thing that could pop up was Apple Pay was kind of ridiculous and kind of monopolistic. And so the fact that they've now, you know, obviously they've been pressured by government, but the fact that they've at least volunteered without having to wait 5 years for the DOJ case to finish, I'll take it as some. Give them some credit for that. Because at least it now makes the possibility for someone to offer some sort of competition if they want to. Do I think that anybody is going to be able to rustle up competition that's good and nice and fair and as good as Apple Pay experiences? Probably not. But you have to at least let people try. The fact that they blocked off entirely was kind of insane. There are security concerns. There are concerns like that. But it is very clearly delineated by the fact that there'll be a page in the settings app where you can choose your default wallet app. And it will default to the Apple wallet anyway. So if you really want to, you can go in there and you can change it. But otherwise, no difference. So I'm glad that they're offering this. They should have offered it before. Out of all the things that various governments are focusing in on, this is probably one that they can easily concede on and hope that it reduces pressure elsewhere. So that's what they've done.
I think it's a good thing that they've done this, and it was inevitable that they would have had to do this at some point. But I do have a little bit of a fear that this is going to lead to some fragmentation in the contactless payment world on the iPhone. Because right now, basically any bank you could think of supports Apple Pay. But what's to stop, let's say, Bank of America in a few months once this is rolled out from saying, huh, we don't have to use Apple Pay anymore. We can create a contactless system that we integrate directly into the Bank of America app. So let's pull all of our stuff from Apple Pay and rely on our first-party solution instead. There's nothing to stop them from doing that. And then on the flip side, you also have retailers who don't take Apple Pay, like Walmart, like Home Depot, like HEB. Is this going to kill any hope of them adopting Apple Pay? Because now Walmart, who has relied on Walmart Pay, which is a QR code-based solution, they've relied on that for years. Now they can get ahead of address the complaints about Walmart not adding tap-to-pay support just by adding NFC support in the Walmart app.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's going to happen.
Yeah, and it's just going to be very disappointing if this leads to more fragmentation and this leads to people having to juggle multiple apps to know which app or which service to use, depending on which card they're paying with, depending on which store they're at. And I think in the case of a company like Walmart with Apple Pay, the fees are probably a little bit of a factor, but the primary factor is the data. They collect less data on people when they use Apple Pay. If you go to Walmart and you pay even with your normal credit card, they're able to link so much data to you, link it to your online account. You might notice that if you shop at Walmart and you pay with a credit card and you happen to have a Walmart account linked to that credit card elsewhere, but when you pay at the store, you don't enter any sort of information to link it to that account. They do it anyway in the background. And I don't know, maybe Apple has some security and privacy things they're going to require to get these NFC and secure element entitlements. But it does raise some concerns, because you could also make the argument that Bank of America wants some more data on their customers that they don't get when they use Apple Pay, so they can add it to their app and collect that extra data.
I completely agree. This opens the floodgates for companies to do some scummy and not as good experience things, but you do have to let them exist.
It was inevitable that this was coming at some point.
Yeah. I mean, the sleight of hand here is that the reason Apple did not open the NFC chip out in 2014 when Apple Pay launched is because they knew if they did that, loads of companies would fight against them and offer alternatives to Apple Pay that would work in different ways that maybe would get more of a foothold. They knew that if they cut it off and only offered Apple Pay, they could offer an experience that would be adopted globally very quickly and very rapidly. And you kind of saw the opposite scenario happen with Android, where for a while there was a lot of competition. You know, you had Samsung Pay still exists and stuff, so it was a bit in around, and it took a while for the Google Wallet native, you know, the first party experience to take hold. Eventually it did, but there was definitely, because of the fragmentation opportunity, there was just more players and more competitors, and it wasn't as seamless. And like Apple Pay became almost like a verb, right? You know, like it became not normal nomenclature, and you see Apple Pay logos at every shop. Even today, I feel like you see there's more Apple Pay presence than there is Google Pay presence. Do they call it Google Pay these days? They change the brand name 500,000 times. But you know what I mean, right? Like the sleight of hand really is that they delayed it long enough before they opened up to competition. They have the inertia and they have the main app. And so do I think that Bank of America will be able to fully pull out of Apple Pay? It's going to be hard for them to do it. But if they do, then they have to compete on merit, right? And customers will either be happy with it or they'll campaign to go back to the wallet or they'll switch banks. So Apple contorted the market for contactless payments in their favor for a long time. Now they're opening up to some competition. Are some companies going to do stupid things like currency? And, you know, was a thing for a while. And obviously Walmart Pay has the same problem. Some people are going to try. I still think in the long term, Apple Pay will be the most dominant player. And most banks will have to carry on supporting Apple Pay as they always have. But at least they can offer some alternatives. And some companies like Affirm, things like that, can also now offer, you know, payment experiences that they never had a chance to before. So there's risk involved. And yeah, there is going to be some hills and valleys in terms of, you know, what experience people can expect. And there will be some diversification, as I'm sure some bank will try and go out on their own. But, you know, Apple Pay is good. People like it. And that's going to let it maintain a foothold for a long time.
If you look at like the market of contactless payment in the United States when Apple Pay launched in 2014, it was basically non-existent. Like, we have been so far behind contactless implementation compared to the UK and compared to other countries. And Apple Pay is the reason that contactless finally took off in the United States. And it's now, I still don't think it's quite as ubiquitous here as it is in the UK. But without Apple Pay having been that central solution, for at least for iPhone owners, I don't think contactless would have caught on for much longer than it did. And I think we'd be even further behind.
Yep.
And in some ways, it reminds me of the CarPlay situation. Like, you can adopt CarPlay, and a lot of cars right now support CarPlay. The vast majority of new cars support CarPlay. But then you have companies going out and doing their own thing. You have GM, who is dropping CarPlay, as we've talked about a whole bunch. And they're facing pushback from their customers, and they seemingly don't care. And I can imagine a bank doing that exact same thing. And I think when it comes to most of the big banks in the United States, I think it's generally safe to assume they're always going to do the most customer hostile thing possible. Like, there are big banks. There are only a few big banks, and they have a lot of power. So if you could even see a world where Chase, Bank of America team up and launch their own thing. So it's not just one bank pulling out of Apple Pay. It's multiple banks pulling out of Apple Pay. So we'll see. I do think looking outside of the payment solution category, you can imagine a lot of cool things that apps can do now with having access to this technology. Whether that's hotel keys, home keys, like rewards cards, I think is a cool one, where you can have an NFC-based rewards card. There are cool things that might come out of this. I am also just, like I said, a little bit concerned about the potential fragmentation possibilities. This week we got iOS 18 Beta 6 and iOS 18.1 Beta 2, alongside all of the other beta season updates, macOS, watchOS, etc. In terms of what's new in iOS 18 Beta 6, let's see, we have a change to the music app, where the Browse tab has been renamed the New tab. For whatever reason, there's no change to the actual content of what's in that tab. I think this tab has switched back and forth like a few times in terms of what it's named, but now we're back on New.
And it was not so long ago that the first tab was called For You, and now it's called Home. They're like,
yes,
they love rebranding the tabs. New as the name of a tab is a bit odd, especially as I feel like that tab definitely shows stuff that isn't new.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It doesn't really make any sense.
Yeah, so Browse was maybe a more accurate name, but I guess for some reason they've decided to change it up. It doesn't match in the other apps, by the way, because, like, you know, Podcasts, for instance, still has the Browse tab with the same icon. That's the thing. Like, maybe you could argue that different tabs need different, maybe Podcasts really does need a Browse tab and Music only has New, but they should probably change the icon to make that sense, because it's still that like abstract set of four squares. But they changed the name of it. So now you have to say, go to the New tab and find whatever playlist.
They've also made an interesting change to the home screen tinting option. So now if you tint your app icons on your home screen based on the color of a wallpaper, that color of the tint and that wallpaper are now linked together. So if you switch to another wallpaper, the tinting will reset. Or if you switch back to that wallpaper, the original tinting will come back, if that makes sense. There's now that link between your wallpaper and the tint, assuming you based your tint on a color in the wallpaper, which is a nice change.
Which makes sense, right? Because you could have red icons because you've got a red wallpaper background, so you want everything to match, and then you have multiple wallpapers that have different themes, and therefore the icons follow along. So that's a sensible little adjustment there. Do we know what the default's going to be when people update to iOS 18? Like,
the default what?
Is it going to be default light mode icons? Is it going to be default automatic?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. I would assume it would be respect your current settings for light mode and dark mode. And if you have dark mode, then it'll just switch to the dark mode icons. I would think that seems like the ideal solution.
Maybe. I don't know, because that'll be an interesting dimension on adoption. Because if they try and, like, if obviously right now there is no default because there's only one setting, right, light mode. But at least when I updated to the last beta, I think I had it on light mode, and I think it put me on automatic because I had to change it back.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know if that's an indication of what the new default is going to be, but I could see them put it on automatic as the new default, and then if you're in dark mode, it makes all your icons dark, and we've got like, wow, what's this? but I'll be keeping my eye out for that as you know, the launch comes around.
I think when you set up a new iPhone now, it asks you during the setup process if you want light mode, dark mode, or automatic. So they'll probably just add another prompt there that appears when you set up a new iPhone and the first time you update to iOS 18. That would be my guess. So they're...
What, just for the icons? I feel like they're going to make it match the system setting, maybe.
Yeah. Or maybe they'll update that prompt to show that it also can link to the icons or something.
Yeah.
I have a hard time. I don't know. I don't think they'll do anything too crazy by default or change anybody's default, but...
But on the just a devil's advocate there, they do change the home screen forcibly sometimes. Like, they slap icons on there that weren't there, and they put That's some true. Widgets on when yeah. widgets launched, right? Like... Because they try and invite people to use the new home screen features. So I wouldn't be like 100% they're not going to change the default to automatic, because I feel like they kind of want to, because then they'll show off one of the new features of upgrading. and the new algorithm for, like, even if an app hasn't provided it, supplied a dark icon, the system does a lot of automatic tinting, right? Like, most icons can be darkened in a pretty convincing way. And even the ones that don't, they just, like, put... reduce saturation, like the Reddit icon. So they've gone out of their way to make the system handle being set to the dark mode pretty aggressively, which kind of made me think maybe they're going to actually put it on automatic to begin with. Because if it was only light mode and then you had to choose dark, there'd be less motivation for them to add in all those, you know, fallbacks for the apps yeah. that haven't updated yet, for instance. So we'll see. I definitely think for new, like if you're a brand new iPhone user, it will default to automatic. Presuming you pick automatic on the theme, you know, during setup. I'm not sure what they're going to do for people upgrading to 18.
One change in iOS 18 beta 6 and iOS 18.1 beta 2, I think, is that there's a dedicated control center toggle for Bluetooth now. This, I think we talked about this at the very beginning of the beta cycle, where Bluetooth and a few other connectivity things were only available in that, like, combo square control center widget, so you couldn't just put Bluetooth. You had to put Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, airplane mode, all collected into that one widget. But now you can break Bluetooth out on its own, which is useful.
Yeah, because previously the square 2x2 widget of those toggles would have Bluetooth at the top level, so you could toggle it directly.
Right.
Whereas on iOS 18, they put Bluetooth in the second menu, so you can see the state of it. But if you click on it in that little huddle, it then opens the bigger screen of all the controls that you can toggle. So that's still the case. Like, that set of four, which will be on the default layout, will put Bluetooth a layer lower. So some people can be mad about that. But now, if you really like Bluetooth, you can have a separate toggle that is Bluetooth standalone to toggle that.
iOS 18.1 beta 2 also kind of gets things in sync between 18.0 and 18.1. So you have distraction control now and the changes to the Photos app that we talked about last week. There are still some inconsistencies between the two builds right now, but we're getting closer to things being on track.
Yeah, it's aligning, and you can imagine that in a, you know, it's only going to be a couple more weeks, iOS 18 will be done, and then they'll be releasing 18.1 builds for, like, my phone too, for instance.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Anything else on these new betas?
Just, I guess it's been another week round of the point ones that you've been on there. Like, any updates on intelligence, like read notification summaries or anything? Anything crazy that you've spotted? Or I saw one thing that popped up on social media where the priority section in the mail app was prioritizing spam and phishing attempts. So it was like a fake Apple iCloud email, like reset your password. But it wasn't, you know, it was obviously a phishing attempt. But the Apple intelligence had put it in the priority section.
That does relate to one of the changes I've made. I disabled the priority messages thing altogether in the mail app just because I didn't like what it was showing. And again, like we talked about a couple weeks ago, I am an inbox zero mail app purist, so it just wasn't that useful for me. Because once there's things just get stuck in that priority mail section, like it's there until you archive the email, I think, which just doesn't really work with how I use my inbox. So I turn that off.
Like, there's no way to, like, swipe on it and, like, remove it from the priority section.
No.
It's just always there. Yeah.
Other than that, I think I like the notification summaries for messages. I really, really, really like the summaries in the mail app that appear like in line. So mm-hmm. not the priority notifications, but the summaries that appear on your inbox view. Even for something like, you probably don't know what this is, but in the United States, we have this USPS Informed Delivery Digest email that we get from the post office every morning that shows like the mail and the packages you have coming today.
Oh,
and in
that's fancy.
18.1 with Apple Intelligence, it does a really good job of summarizing that. And just in the preview line in your inbox, it shows mail coming today, three pieces of mail, two packages. Wow. You can just see it right there.
So you don't have to click through. Post office send you an email every morning with what's coming to your house?
Oh, yeah. It's a shocking example of the government and the post office doing something cool and technologically advanced. It's a very shocking example. But yeah, it's, and they like scan the email so you see the envelope and everything. It's very fancy.
Wow. Yeah, we don't get that level of service with our Royal Mail. The packages come. Obviously, if you do couriers and stuff, they send you emails.
But, yeah, right.
And Royal Mail has track delivery and stuff, but like general mail just shows up when it shows up. We don't get email alerts.
There are issues where you get an email showing you a letter that's coming that day, and it doesn't come, and it never comes. And sometimes it might look like a very important piece of mail, so you just are super paranoid that you missed something saying you're going to jail because the post office lost it. But more often than not, it's very useful. Other than that, I find myself accidentally activating the type to Siri thing quite a bit because it's meant to show up when you double tap the home indicator at the bottom. And for some reason, like how I hold my iPhone or how I swipe on my iPhone, I'm accidentally activating that a lot. Maybe that's something they'll tweak throughout the betas. Other than that, nothing too crazy to report on Apple Intelligence. It's kind of just there. And a lot of the things on my iPhone I don't really have a use for right now, like writing tools or smart replies and messages, I don't think is very useful. But we'll get there. I have used writing tools a few times on the Mac. And the interface, again, like I said, is not great, but it does do a decent job of checking for typos and making suggestions. 18.1 Beta 2, also we should point out, has no changes to Apple Intelligence. So we still don't know how quickly they're going to iterate on A, improving the features that are available now, and B, adding some of the missing features.
Yeah, in the private frameworks, they brought back some of the Image Playground related stuff.
Yeah.
Back in, which was previously removed from 18.1, now it's back in, but obviously it's not exposed publicly, so they could still defer that to 18.2 or something.
And I know some people are seeing the Genmoji button in the Messages app on the keyboard. I am not seeing it, but some people see it. It doesn't do anything, but it's there. So maybe that's a sign that's coming soon. But yeah, right now 18.1 is just the same set of features as it was last week.
Finally this week, Happy Hour is sponsored by Shopify. Check them out at shopify.com/happyhour. If you're thinking of starting a business or you already have a small business, are you using Shopify? And if not, why not? Shopify helps you sell everywhere and you don't need coding knowledge to get started. They have a bunch of free website templates that can get you up and running, and they'll handle payments, secure transactions, and shipping. The Shopify platform runs on servers in their cloud, so you don't have to think about managing services or hosting or anything complicated like that. You just focus on doing what you do best. And as you get bigger, Shopify is there with all the tools, knobs, and dials to tune your e-commerce site to your needs. It's there for you when you're just starting out, selling your first products online, and it grows with you, even if you launch in retail and hit success with millions of orders. Whether you're selling security systems, PC components, or maybe you're a Mac developer wanting to sell direct to your users, Shopify is the answer. They have all-in-one commerce and in-person point-of-sale solutions that can work seamlessly together. I've personally sold stuff as an indie dev before online and done it all by hand. And even though I had the know-how to like program it, it was so much work and hassle that on reflection really wasn't worthwhile. Whereas what I love about Shopify is that it's so simple and it has everything you need in one place. So if you hit the jackpot and you get big, you aren't stranded waiting for a dev team to build out all the necessary functionality. Shopify just has it there waiting for you. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, with global reach supporting millions of entrepreneurs across 175 countries. That's because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. So sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/happyhour, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/happyhour now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/happyhour. Thanks to Shopify for sponsoring the show.
I've been really dreading talking about this next topic for the past week. And I think that is part of the reason why Apple keeps doing this. So we're going to talk about it to prove them wrong. Some more changes to the App Store linking out rules in the EU in response to the Digital Markets Act. So these are the rules that apply if you have an app and you want to include a link that takes you outside of the app to complete a payment other than using Apple's in-app purchase system. So previously, there are a few different elements to this change. So the first are changes to the requirements for the link itself. Previously, Apple said that links had to be statically defined, go only to the developer's website, and could not use any parameters to identify the user. And with that, Apple has removed all of those restrictions. So apps can offer actionable links with as many dynamic URLs as they please, and the links can take users anywhere. And the URLs can include parameters as long as those parameters are not used for advertising or user profiling. These links can also now kick users out to their web browser like Safari.
Or
in an in-app web view. Previously, you could only be kicked out to Safari, but now you can open it as a web view in the app itself. These changes, I think, are all good. They're all fair. They kind of address some of the extreme pettiness that we saw with the first set of rules that Apple announced.
Oh, and it's basically what the EU was asking for.
Yes, like, exactly.
They wanted free flowing links, and Apple is basically, all those restrictions they put on the single link, you know, static URL, blah, blah, all that's gone. They've wiped that out. You can have whatever links you want, basically, as long as you agree to this new, you know, link out entitlement and go down the other path. The thing about the parameters was pretty crucial because it stopped apps from like sending a user to a checkout page that was actually associated to their account. Because like they'd always have to take them to like, let's just use Spotify, even though, you know, Spotify is never going to be happy, but they're never going to use this stuff. But just they're the obvious example. So imagine they did do it before. It would be spotify.com/premium would be the only URL they'd be allowed to link to. And so then you'd be in the Spotify app, you'd click the link, it would take you to Safari, and then you'd have to log in again because the URL has no association with your account. Now they could send it to spotify.com/premium/checkout/user ID=BenjaminMayo, and it would take me directly to the right place for me to pay and sign out. And they could even push the web view up inside the application, which is almost like offering alternate payment processing inside the app, right? Like, there's not much distinction to a regular person and whether it's a web view panel or a native panel. So that is all fine and Gucci, and the EU would be very happy about that. The other little thing they did here was that previously, you know, that scare sheet that would come up and it'd be like, Apple, you know, you're going to transact purchases outside of the Apple ecosystem. This is scary and bad and don't do it, blah, 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 continual cancel. Mm-hmm. That sheet previously was defined in terms of the design by Apple, but the system didn't show it. Apple required each developer to make a copy of that sheet to include in their app that matched Apple's design requirements to present, which was like a huge workaround of stupidity, right, and nonsense. Apple have finally committed that in a future iOS 18 update, they will add a capability to the custom link API that will show the system will present the sheet. So no more will all the app developers who supposedly want to use this stuff have to go and make an exact match of the design that's described on the Apple website. The iOS will just do it itself, which is how it should have worked from the beginning. But obviously they didn't bother doing it until now. So they made it slightly easier as well.
So that's all fair and good and overdue. But Apple's not just doing all of that out of the kindness of its heart. There are a new fee structure for all of this. Apple is basically introducing two new fees. We have the initial acquisition fee and the store services fee. So the initial acquisition fee is a commission on sales of digital goods and services made by a new app user across any platform that the service offers purchases. And it applies for the first 12 months following the initial download of an app with a link out entitlement. So this is, let's say again, Spotify, for example. You download Spotify in the first 12 months. If you make a purchase in the Spotify app that's a digital good or a service, Apple will get a cut of that. The cut is 5%, and it applies to whether you're using the new EU alternative business terms or if you're continuing to also offer your app inside the App Store under the standard business terms. So 5% in both scenarios.
But not just 5%.
Yes, that part seems relatively straightforward. Things get a little bit messier with the store services fee. So the store services fee is a commission on sales of digital goods and services applying to purchases made on any platform, and it applies within a fixed 12-month period from the date of when you install the app, update the app, or reinstall the app. So basically anytime you engage with the app store, engage with the app itself. The store services fee, if you're operating under the new EU alternative business terms, and keep in mind that's where you'll also pay the core technology fee for those developers who meet the 1 million download requirement. In that scenario, the store services fee is 10%, reduced to 5% for members of the small business program or on a qualifying renewal of a subscription after 1 year. If you're continuing to offer your app inside of the App Store under the standard business terms, the store services fee is 20%, reduced to 7% for members of the App Store Small Business Program or on that subscription renewal.
So in sum, 25%, right?
Yes,
pretty much. If you're in the App Store, which Apple says is cheaper than what they previously asked for, because previously, if you did linking out to the web, it was 27%. So now you've got a 2% discount. And the real kicker is that it's not 25% of transactions that result of you clicking on the link.
Exactly, it's yes.
25% of anything just because you happen to install the app first. So like, if you already had a Spotify account active and you downloaded the Spotify app, Apple's not going to take a cut out of their incredible generosity. But if you don't have a Spotify, if you haven't paid for Spotify, you download the Spotify app first, any time within the first year that you then go and buy Spotify, whether you buy it through the iPhone, whether you buy it through the web, whether you buy it through the browser of an Android tablet, you know, whether you buy it by phoning Spotify up and talking to them over the phone, whether you see an ad on a, you know, bus stop that says go and buy Spotify, whether even if Spotify paid for App Store search ads to promote their app to you, and then you went and got it again and reopened the app and bought it that way, Apple still wants the 25% cut. After a year, that 25% cut drops to 20%, or because it's a subscription, it would then drop to 7%. But still, it applies on everything you're buying, off-platform or on-platform, which is a level that no one is going to agree to.
It's also a level that, realistically, how do you even enforce that? How is Spotify... So let's say you download Spotify from the App Store, right? And you never use it. You never sign into an account. They can't link it to you in any way. Then 6 months later, you fire up your Mac and you go to Spotify.com and sign up. In that situation, Spotify is technically supposed to give Apple its cut.
Mm-hmm.
But A, Spotify really has no way of knowing the analytics on that. If Apple still threatens that they can audit you and make sure you're paying your fair share, however they want to do it. They can act like the IRS and they can audit you. Even in a scenario like that, it's very hard for somebody to prove that they had also originally downloaded that app before they signed up, or that they're even the same person, right? They don't know that. It's very much an honor system.
Yeah, like practically speaking, you need someone to download the Spotify app and log in, right? To at least
associate
an account. Yeah. But this amount, this percentage, whether it's 5, 12, 20, or 25, like, it doesn't really matter. There's no way that the companies are going to be happy with it. The EU is not going to accept it. The EU's mad enough about the core technology fee, which is a 50 cent fee per year, right? This is 25%. It's like, it's just a ridiculous figure that, you know, Apple has enough problems trying to justify taking 15 to 30% of transactions using Apple in that purchase.
Yeah.
Like, how do you justify a 25% cut of stuff that is happening completely off of your platform? If it was, even if it was maybe 25% of the transactions that you make, because you directly click that link, and within a 7-day period of clicking the link, they're counting it as your conversion through them, at least then it's somewhat reasonable. But the fact it applies for 12 months, and on an ongoing basis, by the way, because so Apple converted you, let's even just assume Apple deserves full credit for converting you to a subscriber. Every single year, regardless of where you buy it, just because you now have the app installed and it's all going to auto-update, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't have to open the app. The app can just be on your device auto-updating. It's just like the coordinate fee in that regard. It doesn't actually matter if you launch the application at all. As long as it's on your phone for the next forever, you'll be due the store services fee cut to Apple on whatever you advertise or promote to anybody. Like, if after you would do the first install, you then spend £10 million on a TV marketing campaign that then draws in a load more upsells of Spotify Premium or Spotify Premium Plus or whatever else. You know, even if they introduce new products that never existed before, Apple's still going to be, hello, we want our money, you know. It's just unrealistic and stupid. So I don't know why they even come to the table with something like this. I guess they have to. And then this is admittedly just going to be one of the things that shows up in the little EU website where they're like, we are reviewing compliance on this particular, on the store services fee and the initial acquisition fee. And then they'll have to change it.
I think all of the numbers we've been throwing around the 5, 12, 20, 25 kind of just highlights part of Apple's strategy here, which was just to overwhelm developers with so many numbers and so many fees and so many options to where it's, I don't know, it's so hard to make a decision and to know what is best for your business, what is best for your app, because there are the unknowns. There are all of these different rates. There's the core technology factor of it all, where if you cross over that 1 million download threshold, you have another fee to pay. You have so much of it being on the honor system with the looming threat of an audit from Apple where Apple can come in and say, hey, we think you shorted us by $500,000. You owe us $500,000. Good luck.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so much that a developer has to take into account before they do this that I think it will just scare a lot of particularly one person indie developers away from doing it. And I think
indie developers are never going to do it anyway for different reasons because they're not big enough. Right? This is all about big companies. It's why Spotify is the go-to example. But Spotify and other big companies have no incentive to comply and do any of this stuff at the moment because they know if they just stand on the sidelines and keep fighting it, the EU is still investigating. So you know, it's just like a three-way negotiation where Apple announces some stuff that is clearly unviable or in some ways unviable. Spotify and everybody else say it's stupid and why they, you know, how they dare do it. And then we just wait a few more months for the EU to basically say the same thing. So like, anything they keep announcing, it's kind of like, well, what's the point? In 3 months, there's going to be a different proposition. Like, I don't know when eventually we get to the end state, but we haven't got there yet.
I think it goes back to what we've talked about. I think every time we talk about the DMA and the EU stuff, where you have, again, we'll use Spotify as the example, where you have three clear parties. You have Spotify, you have Apple, and you have the European Commission. What Apple is doing is clearly unreasonable. What Spotify wants, which is to pay nothing, give Apple nothing, ignore the fact that Apple is the platform operator. They want to pay nothing. Then you have the EU in the middle of it who, I don't know what their motive is, but it's clear that they aren't doing a very great job of laying out what they want Apple to do. And when you put all three of those parties together, it just leads to situations like this where, when are we, like you said, going to hit that point where we have a stable EU-approved set of policies? And right now, it's looking like we're so far away from that.
To be fair to the EU, each time Apple comes around, they do make concessions that they didn't before.
That
is
true.
Like in this case,
yeah.
The link out policy in terms of, you know, parameters, as many links as you want that can be dynamic, that's actually way better than what they previously, you know, offered in January.
Yeah.
So the EU is probably quite happy about that. Now we're just fighting over the percentages and the money. So in some ways, like, the EU is kind of, it's trending in the EU's favor, right? Like, it's not like Apple's being able to stand its ground and win. They stand their ground, the EU tells them to change it. So I guess the EU's winning slowly. It's just taking a very, very long time for it to actually settle.
All right, let's talk about something a little more fun, a little cool. Another new report from Bloomberg says that Apple is ramping up its work on a tabletop smart home device with a robotic arm. And Bloomberg says this is meant to serve as a smart home command center, a video conferencing machine, and a remote-controlled home security tool. It's three things. Are you getting it yet? Targeting a price allegedly of under $1,000 with a release in 2026 or 2027. The clear reasoning for that expensive price is Apple's plans to make it swivel. So Bloomberg says that it will swivel left or right or up and down and be able to spin 360 degrees. It would use an actuator to do that, with a thin robotic arm connected to the screen to move it around. And the main interface for interacting with this device will apparently be Siri with some of the new and forthcoming Apple Intelligence features. Bloomberg says it currently runs a modified version of iPadOS, and Apple is working on features like voice recognition. So if you're, say, on a FaceTime call or just talking to Siri on the thing directly, you can say, look at me. And then the thing will be able to swivel and look at you, like you told it to do. I go back and forth. I think this is very cool, but I think it's perhaps an example of people, of Apple being very out of touch with what people want from Apple in the smart home. $1,000 robot arm swiveling iPad HomePod weird combo device is cool, but I don't necessarily think that's what most people want or what most people even buy. Yeah, at that price point.
We literally had this conversation on an episode a couple months ago.
I was just, as I was saying that, I was like, I think we just talked about this. Like,
yeah, because I think it was the HomePod with the screen and there were some rooms that maybe it swivels, so maybe it's the same project, right?
Yes.
And if you're going to make a HomePod with a screen, it makes sense that it can rotate to face you because you can then walk freely around your kitchen and it can follow you and so you can still see the screen and look over it from wherever you are. But you don't necessarily need like articulated limbs and actuators and robotics to make that happen, right? Like, the Amazon Echo Show, third generation, or whatever it's called, maybe it's called the Echo Show 10, third generation, for whatever reason, but that tablet slash thing is literally, it sits on a speaker stand, it looks like an Amazon tablet, and it swivels to face you, and you can say, look at me, and it turns and faces you, and it just rotates, you know, 180 degrees or whatever, and do you know how much that costs?
$200?
$300.
$300, okay, yeah. And Apple is targeting, hoping, under 1,000.
Yeah, exactly.
hoping.
I think it's great. You're going to make a HomePod with a screen. You should do 100% do it. And it would be pretty cool if it could rotate to look at you. I don't know what additional value you get out of making something that can like support 6 degrees of freedom motion and rotate, you know, 360 degrees and, you know, have a full robotic limb on like the iMac G4. Like, it doesn't need to be that complicated in my... Maybe I've got a limited mind and a limited imagination, but it's struggle to think what the use cases are beyond making the thing look at you, which is handy. But beyond that, why do you need to, the extra expense is off the chain. And I'm never expecting Apple to make a product that's as cheap as what Amazon make, because that's just not what they do. It's always going to be more expensive. The $300 Echo Show 10 with a screen that rotates is the same price as the HomePod that doesn't have a screen at all, for instance. But $500, somewhere around that, feels a lot more reasonable than... 1,000? Like, I'm not sure you can really come up with enough use cases that people are going to want to go out and spend $1,000 for that particular device. Maybe I would, but I don't think it's going to be mass market, which is the exact same conversation you can have about the HomePod as well. Good product, too expensive, doesn't get a lot of sales.
Yeah, then we're going to end up in a situation in a few years after this, or a couple years after this thing comes out, where Apple says, huh, nobody's buying this thing. We should just discontinue it. And it's like, yes, nobody's buying it because it's insanely expensive and this isn't what most people want.
And over-engineered and yes. Blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
Like, nobody's buying the HomePod because it's expensive. Nobody's buying Vision Pro because it's expensive and over-engineered.
The Vision Pro is a bit different. I think the Vision Pro has to be expensive to, like... Yeah.
Well, this thing has to be expensive if they want to put it on a robot arm. Like, that's expensive.
Yeah, but why are they putting it on a robot arm?
Well, yeah, like, I mean, that's another question, but...
Like, the thing with the Apple Smart Home strategy... The Vision Pro thing I actually completely get. Like, everyone loves to joke about it and be like, oh, they've only sold 400,000, you know, this year, blah, blah. But like, on the assumptions of them heading into that product, I feel like they knew it was only 400,000. That's when they made it, built 400,000. They're working with micro-LED screens that only make a million a year. You divide by two for each eye, there's 500,000. You know, like, Apple's not stupid. They figured that out and they saw the roadmap. I actually think they're doing it's as expected. With the home stuff, I generally think there's people in Apple like, we'll make this thing. It's going to be a grand, but it's going to be awesome. And people are going to buy it in droves. That's where I feel like they're a bit disconnected. It's like a different, like the Vision Pro is a different set of issues or set of problems. Like this, they have smart home products that are pretty good. They're just slightly too expensive and they don't push them down market enough, or they don't make versions that are cut down. Like the HomePod Mini is perfectly fine, but they need a HomePod, big HomePod that's $100 cheaper, for instance, but they never make one. And then the expensive products that they do ship, they don't get enough love and attention. They don't get ongoing development and generation after generation new models come out. Like, the HomePod has had two models since 2018, and the second model was basically just a revival of the first model. Like, it's not like they added new functionality to it, really, right? Like, it's basically exactly the same. Yeah. So the problem with Apple's smart home lineup is there's not really a lineup. There's two products that are, I think the Mini's fine or whatever, but the main HomePod is like too expensive and doesn't quite fit the bill. And they just need more stuff, more cheaper stuff, slightly more expensive stuff. Like, what the problem here is, you could have $1,000 rotating arm thing if you also had a suite of products that hit different price points too in between. Prioritize a HomePod with a screen on it, right? Ship that thing. Then you can worry about making a robot or a robotic arm version. Like, just take the HomePod as it is today, pretty good speaker, slap a big iPad-sized screen on it, give it a visual indication, give it UI, right? It doesn't have to be as expensive as $1,000 to do that. And find somewhere to make it a little bit cheaper. Compete with the Echo Show is basically what I'm saying. You don't need to be fantastically, marvelly, technologically crazy going into the worlds of auto-robotic technology. Like, that's just punching too high when you don't need to. There's lower-hanging fruit to pick that they just don't seem interested in.
The latest problem with Apple's smart home strategy, or lack thereof, is Apple Intelligence. Like, yes, it sounds like this $1,000 robot will be able to use Apple Intelligence, but Apple sells smart speakers that, again, because they just don't get updates and they don't get enough love, aren't going to support a single Apple Intelligence feature, whether that's natively or with some sort of mirroring or pairing to a nearby iPhone. It's like Apple has all of these AI and upgraded Siri plans, and the speakers they make that are in part dedicated to interacting with Siri just aren't getting any of it. It's just such a weird balance and an example of Apple not really reading the room. And it's disappointing, even if this product sounds so expensive, but it sounds so cool. It's just not what most people, including myself, really wants out of a more expansive Apple smart home ecosystem. All right, I think that does it for this week. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a rating and a review. You can also find an ad-free version of the show with bonus content every week at 9to5mac.com/join. Again, please send us some Ask 9to5Mac questions for next week, episode 500. We'll answer some of them, do some recollection of the past 10 years. You can find me on Threads, Twitter, Mastodon, at Chance H. Miller. And Mayo, what about you?
At BZA Mayo.
All right. Thanks, Mayo.
Bye-bye.